KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sundartha Mukherjee, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician at Columbia University Medical Center. A Rhodes Scholar, he graduated from Stanford University, University of Oxford, and Harvard Medical School. He has published articles in Nature, the New England Journal of Medicine, the New York Times Magazine, and the New Republic. Sundartha Mukherjee is here today to tell us about his book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, published in 2010. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What led you to write your book, A Biography of Cancer?
Well, I wrote the book really to answer a question that a patient had raised, and actually she was not the only one. There were several people who had raised this question. And this was a woman who I was treated for abdominal cancer, and she said that she was willing to go on with her treatment, but she wanted to know what she was battling. And it was a very poignant question for me. I was then training as a fellow in cancer medicine, and it was poignant because I could not answer her question, I couldn't point her to a resource to answer this question. And the disjunction was incredible. Here was a disease that had enveloped certainly her life, but was enveloping all our lives, or a family of diseases that was enveloping all our lives. And there was no history or, you know, no recent history of cancer. So I felt as if there was a gap, a lacuna, and I wanted to address that. And that was the reason that I decided to write this book.
How widespread is cancer worldwide?
Well, it's a little bit hard to estimate the exact rate because it's underdiagnosed in many places, so we don't know exactly. But that said, in 2000, I think there are total about 8 to 10 million men and women will died of cancer. Cancer was contributing to about 10 to 15% of all deaths worldwide, so it's a major killer.
How does frequency of cancer in the modern world compare with the past?
Well, we know that based on prior studies that, in fact, the incidence of cancer in the world has been increasing over time. And there's been recently a lot of interest in this question, and I talk about this question in my book. One reason that's been increasing is because the population is aging overall, and many forms of cancer, not all forms, but many forms, are age-related. Breast cancer is one of them. Prostate cancer is one of them. So as we age overall, and as we are not killed by other things, cancer becomes more and more predominant. But that's not the only reason. There are other reasons. One of them is the fact that we are diagnosing cancer earlier and earlier, like in breast cancer, like in prostate cancer. That's the second reason. And then there's a third reason, which is that there are new forms of carcinogens that we've recently introduced, at least recently in terms of world history, such as tobacco. And that has also driven up the spectrum of cancers, for instance, in breast cancer. So there are a variety of different reasons that are contributing to the apparent increase of cancer incidence in the world. Now, if you look at cancer survival, or if you look at cancer mortality, there's a slightly different picture. In fact, for the United States, overall cancer mortality increased between the 1970s into the 1980s, then reached a plateau. And in fact, for several years, nearly a decade, it has fallen over time.
In your book, you point out that different types of cancer aren't the same disease. Would you explain?
So there are many, many senses. It's true that different forms of cancer are not the same disease. Now, first, let me explain that the reason that we call these diseases cancer is that there is a deep biological commonality, and that is cancer is the abnormal growth of cells. So all these variety of forms share this fundamental common principle. Occasionally, this is matched with an uncontrolled death of cells. So in other words, an overabundance of growth and an inability of cells to die appropriately. But that said, for instance, the genes that alter or turn on breast cancer are quite different from the ones that turn on prostate cancer. The host environment in which one breast cancer grows is very different from the host environment in which another breast cancer grows. And so you have an enormous level of diversity underneath this sort of relatively unifying umbrella.
Would you talk also about the ability of cancer cells to spread?
Absolutely. So the process is called metastasis. This is a process by which cancer goes from one localized area into other areas of the body. It's actually an interesting word. It comes from metastasis, which means unstable or partially stable. And it reminds us that cancer has this ability to have this kind of metastable or partially stable state. And we're beginning to understand as scientists and researchers what causes metastasis. But it turns out that every cancer has a relatively unique spectrum of metastasis. For instance, prostate cancers love to go to the bone. lung cancers like to go to the liver and to some extent the bone and other places. And we now know there's a hypothesis called the seed and soil hypothesis. In other words, part of that is driven by what the cancer is. That is, lung cancer is different from prostate cancer, is different from breast cancer. But also, like seeds, they're also seeking out their particular soils. They're going to only the bone or only the liver. And we're beginning to understand finally at a molecular level what the seed and soil determinants are for every form of cancer. It's a real mystery, actually.
How has the pattern of different types of cancer changed over time?
Well, some have increased, some have decreased, and some have gone away, and new ones have arisen. I'll give you a couple of examples. Lung cancer, particularly among women, for instance, was spectacularly rare in the 19th century. It was so rare, actually, there's a moment I describe. You know, early textbooks of pathology, even in America, didn't even have sections on lung cancer. It was so rare that women were almost never diagnosed with lung cancer, and we know the reason for that, and that is largely because of smoking. So that's one cancer that's changed dramatically over the last century. Another cancer, stomach cancer, for instance, some variations of stomach cancer increased and then have actually gone down. And it has to do with the way we preserve food and exposure to a bacterium. So the various changes in modern life that have changed stomach cancer. Just one last example, very notorious example, prostate cancer. Prostate cancer incidence is going up partly because we're diagnosing it earlier and earlier using these non-invasive PSA tests, for instance. And so that's a cancer that's changed not because we've changed the behavior of cancer, but we've changed our behavior in diagnosing cancer.
What have we learned over time about the underlying cause of cancer?
Well, cancer is caused by many different kinds of events. But again, the deep biological commonality is that in the end, typically, these events change genes that fundamentally control the growth of cells. So in other words, the very genes that allow our embryos to grow and our hair to grow or our brains to grow, if you mutate or distort these genes, you can ultimately unleash cancer. Now, you can mutate, you can distort these genes through a variety of mechanisms, either, for instance, by carcinogens. Occasionally, viruses, exogenous viruses, will cause a mutation or a distortion, or they can co-opt some of these genes. And finally, of course, the genes can be distorted or mutated by accident. When cells divide, they make errors in copying their genes. But once again, we're finding that there's a commonality here. There's a diversity that overlies all of this, but then there are deep common biological principles.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of the book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. To what extent are cancers curable?
Well, the word cure is a very seductive word, a very tantalizing word. It's been with us for a while. In the book, I actually talk about how complex that word is. If you take it at face value, the word cure really refers to the fact that a person with cancer is given some form of therapy and their lifespan therefore becomes equivalent to someone who does not have that cancer. As you can imagine, that's a hypothetical experiment, so it's a difficult question to judge. Now, that said, which forms of cancer are curable? Well, many forms of cancer that are localized, such as breast cancer, which is localized, is curable. Localized prostate cancer is curable. In fact, even localized pancreatic cancer might be curable. The trouble is that once these cancers spread outside their local position, then they become much more difficult to cure. But even so, some cancers that are not localized are curable. I'll give you some examples. Some leukemias, some lymphomas, and testicular cancer, Lance Armstrong's cancer, for instance, represents some cancers that are curable even in their metastatic form.
How have cancer treatments changed over time?
Well, they've changed very drastically over time, but it has to be said that surgery for solid cancers remains the mainstay of therapy. Surgeons do a remarkable job in removing the cancer. And if you can remove the cancer in its earliest stage and therefore get rid of the cancer completely from the body, then you can achieve a cure for even very aggressive forms of cancer. So surgery has been there for a while, although modified in many, many recent ways. Then there's radiation therapy, which involves essentially delivering radiation to kill cancer cells, again, usually typically locally. And then chemotherapy, which is a chemical that goes into your entire body and hopefully discriminates between cancer cells and normal cells and kills cancer cells and spares normal cells and thereby allows you to get rid of cancer cells from the body.
To what extent are tumors that become resistant to our drug treatment a problem in chemotherapy?
An enormous problem in chemotherapy. Again, it depends a little bit on what kind of chemotherapy, but an enormous problem. What's interesting is I gave you the three fundamental examples of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. But of course, the landscape of cancer is now changing drastically. We're learning to understand, for instance, the relationship between the immune system and cancer, or how you can find therapies or drugs that only particularly go and kill cancer cells and spare the rest of the cells, that spare the normal cells. That's also chemotherapy, but chemotherapy in the most modern form possible. Now, what's amazing is that even with these new chemotherapies, even the fact that these highly, highly, exquisitely specific drugs that only kill cancer cells, even with these new chemotherapies, cancer cells can become resistant. It's like a cat and mouse game of evolution. The cancer cells are constantly evolving, constantly making changes, and they become resistant. And therefore, you need to then find another therapy that works and so forth over and over again.
How have recent advances in understanding the cellular biology and biochemical pathways of cancer led to effective treatments?
In a variety of ways, the most important of which has been that in understanding the cancer cell, scientists have been able to figure out that there are specific genes that are activated in cancer cells that are less active or inactive in normal cells, and being able to direct chemicals to prevent these genes from becoming hyperactive or acting aberrantly and thereby killing cancer cells. I'll give you an example of that. There's a drug called Gleevec, which inactivates a very particular gene that is only found in cancer cells. Although, you know, it's not unique for that one particular gene. It has a little bit of a loose spectrum, but quite specific. Let me give you a follow-up example of that. It turns out that that gene that Gleevec inactivates, or the protein that Gleevec inactivates, has a cousin, a molecular cousin, another protein. And that molecular cousin is active in a completely different form of cancer. And so it turns out that a leukemia, which is what Gleevec is used to treat, and a sarcoma, a completely different form of cancer, in both cases, you can use Gleevec to treat both these forms of cancer. Now, if we had not figured out the underlying genes, the underlying genetic anatomy of cancer, no one would have ever believed that a liquid tumor, a tumor of the blood, and a solid tumor of the abdomen would share this common treatment. So this is one fascinating way in which modern therapy and modern genetics is reorganizing the world of cancer, such that, in fact, a leukemia and a stomach cancer become closer than, for instance, even two different variations of breast cancer.
Would you give an additional example?
Well, another example is breast cancer in all its diversity. So we now know that the disease that we call breast cancer actually comes in various different forms. It comes in an estrogen receptor positive form, an estrogen receptor negative form. It comes in a HER2 positive form and HER2 negative form. And each of these forms is treated with a different kind of chemotherapy. So for instance, in estrogen receptor positive, HER2 positive breast cancer, the medicines that you would use are tamoxifen and Herceptin, for instance, and other medicines like that, are completely different. Those medicines would be ineffective and inactive in HER2 negative, estrogen receptor negative breast cancer. So here's another example in which uncovering the genetic anatomy of cancer is leading to a completely different kind of way of treating and managing these various forms of cancer.
And how recent are these treatments?
Well, some of them are actually not that recent. For instance, tamoxifen, which talked about, and I discussed the history of tamoxifen in the book. It's a fascinating history. Everyone should really read it because it's a story of serendipity. It's a story of discovery and of the amazing challenges that women had to go through in order to get on trials for tamoxifen. But tamoxifen comes to us from the 1960s and 1970s. In contrast, Herceptin comes to us from the 1990s, Gleevec from the 2000s. And, you know, just last week, there was yet another new chemotherapy for breast cancer coming out of a trial. So there's a constant invention in some of these therapies.
In your book, you cite recent work with DNA sequencing of tumors that shows 50 or more genes are mutated in several types of tumors. What are the implications of this observation for cancer treatment?
Well, the implications are quite deep. The one thing that we already touched upon, which is an important principle, is that if there are 50 genes that are mutated in one cancer, it turns out that it's that another form of the same cancer, like two breast cancers, might have a different spectrum of mutations. So you might say, well, this is an impossible task. If every cancer has a unique spectrum of mutations, how will we ever, ever discover medicines against these cancers? But it turns out that even though there's a diversity of mutations, there are some deep organizational principles. I sometimes liken it to the human face. There are a million variants of the human face, and yet there's a fundamental geometry to every human face. And much like this, uncovering the genetics of cancer, we're trying to figure out still you know, a 50 might be abnormal in one cancer, a slightly different 50 might be abnormal in another cancer, but they might share some commonalities. And can we direct medicines against those commonalities?
What are the types of genes that tend to be changed in the tumors?
Well, there's a huge variety, but often there are genes that control cell growth. Occasionally, there are genes that control differentiation of cells. And then there are mysterious ones that we don't fully understand, whose function we don't understand. You know, one of the most interesting ones that come to mind are genes that change the metabolism of cells, genes that alter the way cells digest sugar, or they manipulate sugar and oxygen. Now, what on earth are these genes doing in cancer cells? Why are they mutated in cancer cells? Well, this goes back to an observation from a German scientist made decades ago, in which he found that cancer cells have a fundamentally different metabolism than normal cells. And here we are now rediscovering that at a genetic level, and we still don't understand why these metabolism genes are different.
To what extent are the mutations in the cancer cells causal in terms of the cancer cells' behavior, as opposed to just being mutations that aren't really relevant?
So, in fact, there are words for these two kinds of mutations. They're kind of fanciful words. They're called driver mutations, drivers being mutations that really drive the behavior of the cancer cells. But occasionally, cancer cells will also pick up accidental mutations because they're always mutating, and those are called passenger mutations. They're sort of hopping along for the ride. And it sounds easy, the words are easy, but it's an incredibly difficult task figuring out which mutation is a real driver versus which mutation is a passenger. And of course, it's critical because you don't want to direct your therapies against the driver mutations, and you don't want to do anything to the passenger mutations. And one of the real challenges in biology I talk about in the book is, you know, you have the genetic anatomy of cancer. We know what the genes are. We now need to figure out what the genes do. And that's a huge challenge, discriminating between drivers and passengers and finding why the drivers are driving the cancer's behavior.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of the book The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. How have modern cancer treatments affected cancer mortality?
Well, this was a very difficult question to answer several years ago, and you've used the right words. How have they affected cancer mortality? For instance, you can't use the cancer incidence because, in fact, we're diagnosing cancer earlier and earlier, so it will seem as if cancer incidence is going up even as we're inventing new treatment. But, of course, that's a fallacy because all you're looking at is early diagnosis of cancer. So you can look at mortality accurately. But the problem with looking at mortality is that the population is aging overall, and therefore as we age overall as a population, of course, cancer mortality will seem to increase. So what you have to do and what statisticians have done is to age adjust the population, in other words, shrink all the populations such that they begin to resemble each other statistically, and then you can compare apples to apples. And if you do that, it turns out that cancer mortality increased from about 1970 to 1980, then reached a little bit of a plateau, and in fact, for nearly a decade, has been falling in the United States.
For which cancers have we been the most successful in devising treatments?
Well, typically for childhood cancers, particularly acute lymphoblastic leukemia, a cancer that is actually now 70 to 80% curable, for testicular cancer, highly curable cancer, certain lymphomas, but I would say even breast cancer, for instance. Breast cancer is a disease whose management has transformed in the last 20 years. We have new drugs, new ways of managing the disease, and, you know, trying to convert breast cancer into a chronic disease. This has been an enormous victory for cancer medicine.
For which cancers have we been the least successful in devising treatments?
Well, pancreatic cancer comes high on that list. Until recently, melanoma would be high on that list. Esophageal cancer and certain kinds of leukemias, again, have been very recalcitrant to therapy. You know what's amazing is we don't even know why that's the case. Why is it that pancreatic cancer is highly resistant to chemotherapy, whereas a cancer that's formed in a relatively nearby organ, colon cancer, is quite sensitive to chemotherapy, although not fully sensitive? So the variety of responses really begs a molecular understanding of these variations of cancer.
What have been some of the key successes in actually trying to prevent cancer in the first place?
Well, the identification of carcinogens, the idea that a chemical in the environment could be causing cancer by changing the genes, was an enormous moment, a very pivotal moment in the early history of prevention. And in fact, that idea is quite old. Percival Pott, I write about him in the book, in the 1700s, figured out that chimney soot, exposure to chimney soot, would cause scrotal cancer. And yet it took nearly 200 years for us to figure out that cigarette smoking could cause lung cancer. So, you know, prevention has had remarkable successes, but quite clearly there are many, many new carcinogens still to be identified. I mean, this point was brought home to me quite recently by the Million Woman Study, which identified hormones, particularly estrogen-based hormones, which were used to be given for a hormone replacement therapy as carcinogens for breast cancer. It's amazing to me that in this modern day and age, we need a massive trial to figure out that estrogen might be related to breast cancer. So there are so many challenges that still remain for prevention.
Do you think it's possible to eradicate cancer?
I do not think it's possible to eradicate cancer for the reasons that I just told you. I think it's because some element of cancer is ultimately stitched into our genome. It's part of our genetic inheritance. I think it's unlikely we'll ever eliminate cancer from the body. But I think we might be able to convert many cancers to chronic diseases, and that's an enormous victory.
Which cancers do you think we'll be the most successful with in the near future?
Well, breast cancer, we talked about there are women who are living 5, 10, 15, 17 years with breast cancer. Some women with metastatic breast cancer who have 5, 10 years of survival. For them, cancer has become a somewhat chronic disease, although, you know, they enter, as the historian Stephen Chapin has called it, they enter and they cannot leave cancer world. It's sort of like the Hotel California of diseases. You know, it envelops you and never lets you go. But nonetheless, even though the shadow of cancer is present in the lives of these women, they can live with cancer as a chronic disease for 10 years.
What do you see as the best approaches to addressing cancer in the future?
Well, there are many new approaches and we're learning still a lot. One of them we talked about, which is targeted therapy, the idea of being able to direct medicines with exquisite specificity to the cancer cell. Cancer prevention remains a major area, very well supported by the National Cancer Institute, you know, finding new carcinogens, finding out how to prevent them from arising in the population. In fact, trying to decipher a carcinogen even before it becomes released into the general population. That would be a really important phenomenon because you don't want to find out in retrospect that something's a carcinogen. The intersection of cancer and stem cells, a new frontier. And lastly, the understanding of the host. What goes on outside the cancer cell? How does the immune system react with cancer? Why is it that certain people can reject their own cancers? These represent new frontiers of cancer therapy, and I think will bear enormous fruit in the near future.
Your book covers the history of cancer and the discoveries and the people who were involved. As you look toward the future, do you think the way that we're organized to do cancer research and to understand more about cancer is the most productive way, or do you see other approaches than what we've tried up to now?
Well, I think there have been enormous investments from the National Cancer Institute and other institutes to try to find different models. And some models work better in some circumstances and others in other circumstances. For instance, directing a collaborative teamwork was very successful in the Human Genome Project and perhaps in the Cancer Genome Project. In other places, finding drugs, it's been hard to do so. So I think some of these old models will stay the same, but I think we're constantly inventing new models to incentivize researchers to reward them and to allow patients to enter trials to find new forms of cancer therapy.
Do you have some more specific ideas about what could be done?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's been very successful, again, launched through the NCI, has been the idea of creating a vast collaborative networks of scientists and researchers working together, often with advocates, with patient advocates. And there are these particular projects in which you have to collaborate, you're forced to collaborate. And I think those have been very successful.
Would you comment on your view of the focus on treatment versus prevention?
Well, I think we have to do both. You cannot tell a woman with breast cancer or a man with pre-leukemic disorder, well, we should have prevented it because, you know, that person needs to be treated. But that said, I think it is very clear that prevention is a strategy that really needs equal, if not more, attention because, of course, the capacity to prevent cancer is an enormous advance. Our ability to identify carcinogens up front and not retrospectively, as I was saying before, is obviously important because we then will prevent the release of these carcinogens in the human world and thereby prevent cancer up front.
What do you see as the key challenges to making progress in cancer research?
Well, one of the key challenges is technological, or I would say biological. We don't understand enough, and we're trying to explore the cancer cell, and every single cancer is a different disease just because of the heterogeneity. So the heterogeneity and the lack of understanding of the heterogeneity are two very important challenges.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope my book will demystify a disease that has remained mysterious for many years. And by that, I don't hope the book is going to solve the fundamental biological problems of the cancer. But I think that by understanding the past, we can understand the future, and we can understand where we're going next and why we've come here. And that, I think, is very important for patients to realize. I mean, this is a history that I think everyone needs to read, because this is a disease that will affect all our lives.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think the idea that if one reads the history, that for a long time we've been seduced and tantalized by the idea of cure. I think it's unlikely that we'll ever cure cancer outright, but for many forms of cancer, we'll probably learn to control them and to prevent them and to convert them into chronic diseases. And that will be a wonderful achievement for our species.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of the book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, published in 2010 by Scribner. For more information, check on the web at sidmukherjee.com. That's SIDMUKHERJEE.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.